Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome everybody. It seems a little strange to introduce the OSP medical delegation because you're all folks that we know. But we have three of the OSP medical delegation with us this morning. Our own Mark Hilliard, and somebody else's, Mike and Kathy Bassett. And they're here to tell us about their experience in El Salvador last November. And Stacy will be here just as soon as she's here.
She gets in the door.
That's right.
She's probably locked out.
That's right.
Well, you might want to turn around so you can see the screen.
So I don't have to introduce what the medical delegation is all about, but I'm going to tell you, I guess, some about some. Some background and statistics on things. This was our group that went down this year. There were 13 of us. There were supposed to be 14, but somebody had a problem at the last minute, couldn't make it. So, which you probably know about, but I don't tell anybody else about that. So,
that's her story today.
But anyway, as always, a good group. Most everybody, there were only three newbies this year. So that tells you something about the dedication of the team. Everybody wants to go back. And a lot of the people, some people like Mark and Lotsby have been there every year, and most of them have been there 3 years out of our four. So anyway, it's a really good group again. When we get down there, you know, Alfredo, our trusted driver, meets us with the minivan, and we all pile in at the airport. Figure out which way this thing goes.
That looks like a maxi van.
They have two sizes. They have a small one that'll hold maybe 15 people, and then they have the larger one that'll hold 25.
Yeah. Plus all our stuff. Half of it is our stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, our first night there, we're kind of cushy, and we're staying in a really nice place. It's a really pretty place, and getting adjusted to the atmosphere and all that kind of stuff. The medical delegation on our first day, we stay in San Salvador and go through the same kind of routine that we would with just a regular delegation that goes down, where we see some of the significant historical sites. Like, one is this wall. We weren't able to see this year because they're actually refurbishing the park that this is in right now, but there's a wall there that depicts the history of the country starting way back 500 years ago with the Spanish and all the bad things that have happened to them all along. So we go visit that. We go visit the Divina Providencia, which is the chapel, or the Divina Providencia is like a cancer hospital. And there's a chapel there, and that's where Oscar Romero was assassinated, back there on the behind the pulpit and the table back up there. So we learned about that. And sometimes we're able to go visit Oscar Romero's tomb, which is in the basement of the National Cathedral. We didn't do that this year, but depends on our time, our timing and stuff. This is the upstairs in the National Cathedral. We also go visit the UCO, which is the University of Central America. That's where six Jesuit priests and their housekeeper and her daughter were massacred, basically by some of the government troops and things. And there's a museum there called the Museum of the Martyrs, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so they have nice display, a moving display, I guess, of a lot of artifacts and things from when that happened. And there are things from Romero there from Rutilio Grande, that's his shirt there. He was a good friend of Oscar Romero, who kind of when he was killed, that's kind of what triggered Oscar Romero to start taking action, I guess. But anyway, visit that. And then we stop at the artisan shop, so we can, this is our one chance to get some souvenirs and things like that before we actually head for hopping the trusty old bus and head out for Berlin, which is about a 2-hour drive from San Salvador. So there's some really pretty sights along the way. That's the volcano San Vicente. So we drive by that, we usually stop at that spot and take some pictures. But as soon as we hit Berlin, we get to work with the medical delegation. So we have tens of thousands of pills, you know, vitamins and acetaminophen and, you know, all kinds of things that we have to put into packets. We can't take them down. We can't do that up here and take them down because of customs, you know, requirements and things. We have to take them in the sealed packages. So as soon as we get there, we spend hours just going through and filling up the little packets that we're going to give out when we have our day. So then our first day there, we have started the practice of going out to a small village and kind of trying to give the medical delegation people introduction, I guess, into what life is like down there. So we hop in the back of our cattle truck, we call it, this big flatbed truck that we ride around in. And again, the scenery can be beautiful driving out to the villages. This is a cornfield. So if you haven't seen it before, they're like this. Everything's planted one seed at a time by hand and picked and stuff. So these are kind of typical roads.
Kind of looks like Ashworth. Yeah. I didn't say Maryland.
Yeah, it's cattle on the road.
Some of the traffic.
That's the traffic. That's the rush hour traffic. So when we get out there, we meet with the directiva of the community, and the directiva is kind of basically a city council of the community, and it's a chance for them to talk to us and us to learn about them. We can ask them all kinds of questions about what's life like, you know, what are your health issues, what, you know, what are you worried about, how are your crops doing, things like that, and just get a chance to do some one-on-one and get to know the people better. And then we go visit some houses so that we can find out what the living conditions are like. So this is like a typical kind of path that they would have to walk on to get back and forth between their houses and the nearest road or whatever. And this is a typical house. And so we get to go inside and see what living conditions are like. And, you know, talk to the people and again ask them questions. And everybody's very forthcoming and willing to talk to us and wants to help us learn about them and their lives. So, as you can see, they're all dirt floor huts. This is a typical kitchen area. So, anyway, that's kind of our first day there. And then we hold a mini clinic. As I said, we usually pick a small community that doesn't have as many people so that we can cover them in a half day's time. So we can spend the morning, you know, meeting with them and visiting their houses and things like that. And then we spend the afternoon in a mini clinic. But I'll give you a few stats here now. This is a breakdown of the people that went down this year. So we have our biggest contingent, I guess, were the interpreters, the dark blue in the top left corner, and we couldn't do much without them. We had 7 this year, and we had 6 members of the pastoral team that worked with us in various capacities this year, doing things like, you know, coordinating things for one thing, but you know, fixing meals, taking care of us, making arrangements, driving, getting us out there, that kind of thing. We had six physicians that we took down this year. We had four support staff, three nurses. We were supposed to have four, but ended up with three. And we had two people driving us, one in the big cattle truck and one in the smaller pickup that the pastoral house owns. The big cattle truck we rent, so that's part of what the money we raise goes to, is to pay for that transportation and also to pay for the seven interpreters besides buying medications and all that stuff. So, but everybody who goes down pays their own way. And so all the money that's raised is actually operational costs, I guess, and not to get anybody down there. So
the seven interpreters are from that community.
Right. From here. Not necessarily all from that community, but from down there. Yeah. So, and then we had one Salvadoran doctor who went, who happens to be, she's gone with us the last 2 years, and she takes time off and spends the week with us to help us out. And I think Mark will talk more about that, but she's really invaluable as far as helping us know the system down there and that kind of stuff. But she happens to be the wife of one of our interpreters who's been with us for 4 years, so that's how we got her. This is kind of a summary of all the diagnoses, I don't know how to say that. This is what percentage of the people that we saw had these, and some people had more than one of these conditions. So the respiratory was the biggest problem. I think there's probably a lot of flu and that kind of stuff, but there are other issues from smoke in the houses and things like that. Headaches and other. We're going to try to standardize this more I've been working with Stacy, and we're going to do categories that I think fit the medical profession next year, try to standardize it more. But this is how we've done the last couple of years. Anyway, gastrointestinal is the gray, muscular is the yellow, and we had skeletal, blue, green was skin problems. The next blue was parasites. In general, headaches, vision, kidneys. We took down a lot of readers, gave those out. 3% of the people got those. So anyway, we kind of try to keep these stats so that, you know, our sister parish wants us to report back on what are we finding to try to decide. There are things that we can be doing up here to try to help, or what can the medical delegation do, like education and things like that. So, and, you know, do we need more water filters and those kinds of things. And this is kind of a breakdown of percent of patients with each diagnosis by community. So you can see that the dark green line is the total. So in total, on the left is respiratory. 30% had respiratory problems, but if you look at individual communities, like the dark blue line up there was Los Llanes. Obviously, that's a bigger problem. Respiratory problems are a bigger problem in that community than they are in the one with the yellow line, which is El Tablon, Cerna. So hopefully, maybe we start tracking some of this stuff, we can like prepare better. You know, we know we're going to see more of these kinds of, historically speaking, we're going to see more of these kinds of problems in this community. So maybe we need to take more of this kind of medication to that community and less to this other one. But it's hard to tell because from year to year things can change. But anyway, those are kind of stats. And again, I talked about our OSP wanted us to, you know, what can we do things. So some of the health issues we came up with, you know, bad teeth, we can try to help them consume less sugar and stuff, because that's a real problem, especially with the kids, because sugar stuff's cheap. And, you know, more sunglasses, which we did more of this year. We took sunglasses and those kinds of things. So anyway, I'm done. I think it's Kathy's turn. Yes, wake up now.
So Mike alluded to a couple of the things that the reasons for the need to go down there. We'll get a little more specific. Oops. I got the each fall on. There we go. So one of the biggest issues that people have down there, this is one of my favorite maps. I mean, it's depressing and sad. But you're telling me your toilets have water you can drink? Think about it. I mean, realistically, if you have a clean toilet, let's put it that way, you could probably drink that toilet water and you'd be fine. Okay, it sounds disgusting. However, the water that folks have to deal with down there is just horrible. And I'll have some pictures and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But in reality, the life of the people there is very harsh and it starts at a very early age. This little one is maybe 4 years old, but he's already schlepping 30 pounds worth of, I guess that's corn stuff, there's a word for it, for the cattle, for their animals. So, I mean, he's working, he's schlepping, he's hauling, he's barefooted. He might not get to go to school.
The stuff he's carrying is itchy, too.
And and scratchy, and kind of picky, because it's corn. I think it's the leftover corn husk.
Butter, yeah.
People, from a very young age, start schlepping very heavy things. So that little four-year-old, that was probably 30 pounds, maybe 25-ish pounds of stuff. This bag that this guy is carrying is 220 pounds. That's 220 pounds. And I've seen very thin, wiry young men carrying it. And I've seen women about my size carrying these things. Cecilia can carry it, yeah. That's probably 50 pounds. And so there's a lot of skeletal issues that people have, a lot of muscle aches that people have because of their lifestyle. And there's no other options. I mean, literally, there's no other options. That fertilizer that gets delivered to them, you guys always give a gift of fertilizer to San Ysidro. That fertilizer needs to get off the truck and into people's homes and then out onto the fields.
Onto the hillside that we saw.
You saw a picture of, Mike showed you the picture there. It's a cornfield. They're like this. These folks have to schlep, and the terrain is so rough that you can't, you can use some vehicles, but most people don't have a vehicle. Some people, very few people have a horse that they could use. Very few people have a cart that they could use. Most people have a body that they use, and it takes its toll on their bodies. So men and women alike that's almost 50 pounds worth of water on her head. I mean, it's a lovely, beautiful sight. I mean, it's so quaint, right? But think of the physical impact that this woman has doing this multiple times a day, schlepping. Because if they don't have running water, and most of our villagers don't, or if they do, it only falls once a month, they have to go down to a water source, which could be anywhere from, 20 minutes to an hour and a half, 2 hours away. And they have to walk that yucky path with their empty plastic jug, fill their jug, then walk that 45-pound thing on their head back up that narrow path to their homes. And you need more than one of these things to take care of your family today. Again, like Mike said, the fields are like this for the most part, and it's all done. There's no machines. Machines can't do it. It's too steep. People do it by hand, one seed at a time. When they fertilize, they don't spread fertilizer. I know how there's a word for that. They don't
broadcast.
They don't broadcast it. They with their bare hands, they put it on each individual plant. Then there's no waste because it's precious commodity. So they're backbreaking work in the first place because you've got to prepare the field, and it's not just a small season. It lasts for a long time because you have to prepare the field, you have to plant, then you have to put a pre-emergent fertilizer, and then you have to continue weeding or use an herbicide without protection. Then you have to do a post-emergent fertilizer kind of thing and all the time maintaining your field so there's no weeds. So it's back-breaking, constant work under the hot sun and oftentimes a good half an hour away from your home. So you carry your recycled pop bottle of water, and when it's gone, it's gone. And so they're working under that hot sun without much hydration. So here's just a couple of other examples of working in the fields. Basically in El Salvador, there are two seasons, the dry season and the rainy season. In the dry season, people's respiratory issues are exacerbated because of all the dust that flies in the air and the lack of hydration, because during the wet season, the springs that are closer by and the rainwater they can collect into their tanks is more plentiful, so they're able to drink. But when you're well into the dry season, your tanks are dry and it doesn't rain to replenish them. So there's issues with lack of hydration. And then there's the wet season. So you're dealing with dust in the dry season and all the dust mites and everything else that comes with that. And in the rainy season of about 6 months, you're dealing with constant moisture, which brings on mold. And it's just, again, it messes up your respiratory issues. Another respiratory issue is the kitchens that most people have. They are fire open flames. And the flames and the embers sometimes burn all night long in the same space that you sleep. So you're constantly sucking up those fumes. And I've been there, done that, and it's not pleasant. You know, I've only done it a few random times, but these people live it on a daily basis. And it's dusty. It's just dusty and dirty. This is the main diet. sure there's some nutritional value in corn, but we're talking corn tortillas. This is like, it looks like feed corn, but it's dry, and what they do is they make the corn dough out of it, or the flour, to make their nice thick tortillas, which many of you have probably had. And for breakfast, you'll have a tortilla, a little salt. For lunch, you'll have a tortilla, maybe with a tablespoonful of red beans. You might have an egg. For dinner, you'll have tortillas and a little bit of salt. There's not a whole bunch of variety in their diet, so nutritionally, their bodies are weaker. I mean, so there's so many factors that require us to be there. And of the water. So you can drink that toilet water. Look at this good stuff. Do you notice he's cupping and drinking that yucky stuff? That's just nastiness. I mean, we're talking mosquito larvae, we're talking just the elements. Bird just poop. Get into it. Huh?
Bird poop.
I mean, yeah. And thinking about it, you know, those wonderful water tanks we have, there are filters in those, but the rainwater that's collected comes off their roofs. Think about the dust and the yuck that's on their roofs. Fortunately, there are some basic filters in those big water tanks that they have, but they're not perfect. But and again, during the dry season, these tanks should be full, but you're scraping the bottom just for a little bit of water. So, yeah. Any questions on that? It's pretty dire. I mean, there's a reason we're there. We take for granted so much that we have, and during children's time, I'll be talking a little bit about their healthcare system, so that might help you understand a little bit too. I'm going to keep it simple for the children's sake, but you'll get the idea. Get it?
Okay. All right. It's always a mystery on what the slides are, so bear with me.
I found I had more control clicking enter.
Clicking enter, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so for those of you who have been there, this is the Pastoral House's kitchen. This is where we fuel up for the day. The pastoral team makes us delicious food because we need it. We get pretty hungry. Big part of getting our stuff there is loading it up and taking it out, and so we have to do our own loading. And that's some of the team and the translators loading up the truck for the day. And when we get to the clinic site, since we've been there 4 years, we're starting to revisit some communities. So we kind of understand what our facilities are going to be, whether it's going to be a school or a community center or how they open and what we're going to need. And so but sometimes we have to just learn on the fly and set up as we need, and Mike's really good about that, and a lot of our support team, they're creative thinkers, and they know how to wing it and get set up, because when we get there, there's like 100 people waiting, and that's a lot of pressure. Like, you know, they don't want to wait another hour, they want to start, so we got to get set up as quickly as we can. And so the first year we just thought, I think Mike came up with the idea, but how are we going to make these? So we got donated bed sheets and twine, and we make our own exam rooms out of whatever place we had. And this is an example of, we're out in the open, and it's beautiful, but we have a lot of open space, and we want to try to give the patients as much privacy as possible. And this is in a different place, but we're inside a school, and make our divisions there with the same sheets and everything. So, again, in the school and how we kind of organize things. That's the physical therapist and our chiropractor. They don't really need as much privacy, but they want to have kind of some space to themselves. So everybody that comes to the clinic is seen, and we've learned over 4 years that how to be better organized, come up with a number system that the support staff hands out, so everybody's seen kind of in the order that they arrive. The first thing everyone gets is vital signs. And like Mike alluded to, we want to improve every year, and part of that is getting data. And so we're not just working on this during the week that we're down there, it's during the year, collecting that data, looking at it, what we need to improve on, and what we don't need to do. So having that data is important to make that improvement. You know, you can see there things that we've added, like on the table there, there's automatic blood pressure cuff, an automatic temperature, makes things faster, a digital scale, so we can just get that information recorded faster so we can be more efficient. This is kind of how we see this. So in the back there, there's translator and then one of the primary care providers that we had, and then the patient, and everyone gets a full exam. And like Kathy alluded to, you know, some people have some serious problems, and for some of the people, kind of what we term kind of like Band-Aid care, maybe they're just coming there to resupply some Tylenol, because Tylenol here is cheap, but down there it's very expensive. So just getting some basic meds that they can have in their household. If they're not sick during the week that we're there, they have it for when they are sick. And another important thing is they want to have their kids be looked at. Some of these people their kids have never had a stethoscope put on their chest.
Adults never have.
Yeah, so just to know, like, I mean, as a parent, oh, someone's actually looking at my kid, telling me that my kid's okay. You know, that's a big peace of mind thing for a lot of these parents. A really fun part of the day is lunch. So
the relaxing part.
Yeah, it's a nice break. The pastoral team always brings wonderful food. It's a time for all of us. We take two shifts usually, and it's a time for all of us to kind of get together, eat, talk about our day so far, and we usually, one of the community, people in the community donate their space in one of their homes typically, and so we get to kind of see how their family lives, and it's kind of an important social time. So that's a typical lunch. Pharmacy. So as you can imagine, we take a lot of medications down, and everyone wants to leave with something, and we want to give them something. So that usually falls on the pharmacy. So we take down all kinds of medications. We take toothbrushes, we take glasses, and the pharmacy is kind of the funnel for all those things. And so that is a huge job. And the first 2 years, we actually had a pharmacist. And then she got busy, she changed jobs, she couldn't go. So then we had to have either nurses and support staff man the pharmacy. And we also have to have an interpreter, the guy in the striped shirt there. And because you want to give these people instructions, and we do send them with medication that is in Spanish. We translate that so they know what they're doing. But it's a big job. You know, we're giving out medications. We want to do it right. We want to have it safe. And that's another example of how the pharmacy is set up, and that's a non-busy time, which is unusual. So at the end of our clinic day, we like to meet with the directiva, like Mike said, it's like the city council, pastoral team, and we just kind of have a thank you time, a time to reflect. We say prayers. It's really a nice thing to do. It's a really good idea. It's what it's all about. And then we get back on the truck for our drive. I joke about this because, like, you can see I'm, like, the only person standing there. And for people that have been down there, you know, like, if you ride this truck, you're going to have butt sores. So I learned after a couple visits that standing is much better. So all the interpreters that live down there, they sit because they have calluses or whatever. they don't have the soft American butt. So we're back now at the end of the day, and sometimes
it's a medical condition.
Sometimes we get there, you know, late afternoons. A couple times we've gotten home after dark, and so we still got work to do. The work doesn't end when we get back. We have to then reload our tubs with the next day. Sometimes we have to recount medications, and if we didn't get it all done on the first day, which a lot of times we don't, we need to eat, we need to shower, we need to, a lot of, we've been writing a blog to send back to you guys, if some of you have read that, so you guys can kind of follow along while we're down there.
One thing I want to interject too,
yeah,
especially on that picture, was that, you know, we have all these different people. We have doctors, we have nurses, we have support staff, we have the pastoral team, we have interpreters. Everybody pitches in for everything. I mean, there's like no, everybody's equal, everybody is willing to help. There's never any complaining. It's just amazing to me. But I mean, the interpreters who have no reason to help us, they just pitch right in and they're carrying things. And, you know, it's a great experience, I think.
Yeah. Check your ego at the door.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Mark, it seems like you're in a community a half day or one day and that's it. And then the next day you're in a different community.
Yes. Correct.
That whole setup is a...
It's a coordinated effort.
I could address that a little bit. We do basically 4.5 clinics. The first clinic is a half day because that's our education day to help the medical staff understand why they're seeing the problems that they're seeing. And then out of gratitude, we give that little half day clinic in that very small community because they're usually more remote as well, so they can't get to it. And then the pastoral team, we don't decide where we go. The pastoral team decides where we go because they know best where the needs are. And we try to spread the joy. We try not to go to the same places every single year, although now we're starting. As the years go on, we're starting to duplicate. But we try to, they try to spread them out on the mountainside. Because there's 17 different dirt floor villages in the municipality of Berlin, and they're really spread out. And so they'll try to find a place that's sort of centralized. Like, for example, Toblone-Serna, which is Hartman's community. We had a clinic in Toblone-Serna. So it's a smallish community, 45 families. So they get 75 names they can have. The community next door can bring 50 names to a list. And then the other community over here that's not too far away can have 50 names. And then they can share that clinic. So it's not just the community we're visiting, but a couple of surrounding communities. I mean, within reason, because, you know, we don't have 300 hours in a day or energy for that. So that's typically limited to, I think it was 150 people a day that we could logistically feel, but some or take care of, but sometimes more come. And we don't turn to, you know, we sort of have a cutoff time, like if you're not here by 3 o'clock, really, because, you know, we got to get home before dark.
I mean, one thing I didn't mention is we saw 695 people in the 4.5 days of clinics in 5 different communities. The biggest day, I think, was a little over like 205 people we saw in one day. Which was too much.
Yeah. Realistically.
That's the day we got home late.
And that's the reason, you know, we want to have at least 6 medical practitioners there being able to give consultations. And, you know, they don't just go, Mike mentioned, I don't remember if you mentioned this, but that, for example, if they go to see Mark, but they have some real muscular issues, and it's like, oh, you could benefit by seeing the chiropractor. They'll get referred. So one person might see 2 or 3 people, 2 or 3 medical staff there. If Mark sees somebody and says, oh, this is something chronic that I can't help you with, is Samay, the local doctor, available? He'll refer to her so she can follow up and take care of that bigger need. because there's a lot of things we can't solve. We're only there for a day, right? I mean, we can't solve their chronic issues. We can hopefully help them find resources. And that's the joy of having the pastoral team working with us, the local health promoters from the communities, if they're available. They'll spend the day with us sometimes, if they're available. And then Sime, our local Salvadoran doctor, because they know the resources in the country. They know where they can get free help or cheaper help and how to get it and how to petition for it. And if it's a financial need that they need to get to a hospital in San Miguel, which is about, from Berlin town, is about a 45-minute drive. The bus ride takes an hour and a half. But then they have to get to the front of the village. If money is an issue, the medical delegation always leaves money behind, too, to help with transportation, especially for the things that result from our visits. If 20 people come to the pastoral house needing that assistance for transportation or a special medicine or a special exam, folks don't have that kind of money. And so the medical delegation in the past has even passed the hat for specific causes. And any of our leftover delegation monies typically stay at the pastoral house to take care of the needs of the people that come to the pastoral house as a result of us. Because the pastoral team doesn't have money. You know, they need to get it from somewhere. So we try to help that particular cause. So the benefits of the medical delegation last a little bit longer than just the week we're there.
So I can give you a specific example that happened in 2017 when we visited San Isidro Covenants Community. There was a girl, she was like 8 or 9, she came and she was one of my patients. They came and her parents said, she's kind of, what I got, it takes a while to coax out the information when you're getting it through an interpreter. So come to find out, she wasn't in school because the teacher wouldn't let her be in school because she was having these like seizure-like episodes. And so come to find out, she saw someone in the national healthcare, you know, how it works there.
Which is free.
Yeah, which is free. And she saw someone and they gave her medicine, but then they ran out of the medicine. And so she was still having problems and they were looking for me for help. And what we found out is she was gonna have to wait another year to be seen. But for around $45,
didn't she need glasses or something specific like that?
Yeah, that too, I think. But for like $45, she could see a specialist and get in like next week. So $45 doesn't sound like a lot of money to us, but it's a ton of money to them. And but if we're going to have, we don't have a lot of extra money. What we raise every year gets spent, and we start almost at zero every year for the next year's medical delegation. So having extra money so we can help these people, so we had a little visitation with the pastoral house, Kathy and everything, and we were like, okay, can we give them this money, and can we help them coordinate a visit so she can be seen? And that's the type of stuff, you know, that means more than, you know, giving out Tylenol. That's important, but if we can help someone expedite their care like that, then that's really cool. So that was a perfect example of how.
Do you find that some of the people are, I don't want to say immune, but if you were to drink that water, you'd have an awful lot of issues.
Don't use me as an example, because
any
visitor, no. Part of what is provided to the delegates is bottled water. If you were to drink that water, you would have gastric issues that are no
problem. Right, but what about the people that live there is what I'm asking. Are any of them, does it exacerbate their issues?
Oh, yes.
Or are they kind of...
Yes, and there's constant diarrhea. I went to an event once where there were a bunch of Kaibos. This is disgusting, but I'm going to say it anyway. All right, and you know, Kaibos are disgusting in the best of cases, right? But there was like 100,000 people at this event, and I obviously had to go at some point, so I went and I made the mistake. Actually, I did it almost intentionally. I looked down. There was not a solid BM in there at all. It was it was just run. And it was people have constant diarrhea.
Well, but what I'm asking is then...
And parasites.
Yes. So are those kinds of things, are things, when you go in, you can't really treat, can you?
We do have parasite meds, and we do treat them if they're having a...
And what about the folks that are visiting? Like when we went on a tour, we did not go to El Salvador, obviously, but we needed all kinds of shots before we could go. Do you all need shots before you go and meds?
Just hepatitis A and B, that's pretty much it. And your tetanus, that's all you need. There's no malaria there. Dengue is there. Chikungunya was. I mean, it's not as an issue anymore. But it sort of runs in cycles, the kind of typically mosquito-borne kind of things that people have to suffer.
Yeah. When you give out the Tylenol, for instance, how much do you give a family to?
That's a good question.
It's about 40 or 50 pills in a packet. They cost about 30 cents each down there.
So you take lots of empty containers? Or
we have devised
a Ziploc
bag that has interpreted instructions, and we
slap labels.
We have a factory.
So you just give them a little packet of maybe 40 mm-hmm. Tylenol, and that's supposed to last you a year.
Because we only have so much, and then we have to divide it out by the number of people who think we're going to care for it. Physically, we can only take like so much down. Everyone's taking up.
I mean, can you? Oh, so you've got a limitation as to what each person can take
in our suitcases.
Right. Oh, we each take our check bag, which is 50 pounds, and it's completely full of medication. And then all of us take a backpack for our personal supplies. That's how we smuggle.
And we ask other delegations. Import. Like we've got 5 delegations going this summer. And like when I go in March, I'm going to be carrying down all the labeled baggies. So those will already be down there. I'm going to carry down as much as I can on my March trip. And we ask politely and humbly any delegation that goes down if they could take something for us, anything else. And something, you know, if they take 20 pounds of medicines each, that's really
nice. So
that
remains at the pastoral house till the delegation.
Yeah, we have sturdy, sealable tubs that keep the elements out and critters out. And they're all stored up in the dormitory. We've got, I think, a dozen tubs now.
Are all the delegations always out of our sister parish, or are they from?
We have a delegation from Long Island. Mm-hmm. That the Long Island Presbytery has a partnership with one of our communities.
Well, they're all through our sister parish.
Yes, they're all.
That's what I mean. All within the in the
not just the metro area, but even the Long Island.
But they're all part of our sister parish. Yeah. The Long Island group is part of our sister parish.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. So how far outreach does our sister parish go that you're able to draw from?
Do you mean locally here?
No, I mean I know if there's people from, you're talking Long Island, New York, right? Well, so what I'm asking is,
does it have nationwide
or what?
No, not typically. It's more localized because that way we're able to interface personally and support each other. Like, you know, Deb Kellogg, and
right.
Who else goes to the Our Sister
Parish?
Kayla goes to the Our Sister Parish board meetings. It's nice to have that interface, that person, because we support each other. We say, you know, we'll help you with this. This worked, this didn't. You know, we just work together here locally. It's harder when they're farther out. We stumbled upon the Long Island group through a connection that the pastoral team had down there, and they ended up partnering with one of our communities, but they all fall under the guidelines of how we work and how we operate.
Okay.
And there's some definite guidelines. I mean, they're not rules per se, but they kind of are, because they're faith-based. There's just a lot to it, and they Skype in sometimes with us. Yeah.
No, it's okay. I'm probably gonna speed through these slides because there's another thing I want to say, and then maybe there's time for questions. And most of this is just showing you kind of what we do, and I don't need to comment on every one. This was one of the coolest things in 4 years that I've ever experienced down there. Just something that's spontaneous and you don't expect. We're visiting this family's home, and I noticed that, there's a guitar there, and I'm like, can you play us something? And like within 2 minutes, he had told the lady in the striped shirt, she runs all the way to her place, I can't believe there's a full stand-up bass there in El Salvador, but there is. And she brings it, and they play, and they sing, and it was just magical. So I love that. That's one of my favorite memories. So the last thing I want to say is a couple years ago, I met a little boy that had a growth disorder, and I brought that to you, Daniel. And I know that some of you contributed to him. And so this past year, I was able to see him again. And we did see some improvement, and that was wonderful. As everything in life happens, there's no perfect scenario, and there's always something to learn from. And so what we learned from the pastoral team, communication is difficult, like to follow up on these people. They live way far away. We have to get a second, third-hand information. Found out that he also was getting money from another person. And initially, you know, you feel kind of like cheated on or something. Or like, you know, it's like, but I, like, wouldn't I do the same thing? I mean, if someone's offering you money, you know, wouldn't you just take it? So we kind of have, basically it's a learning process for us on how we deal with these situations, and because we don't just give all the money to the family when they have a need like this. They had to come each month all the way to the pastoral house, get the money for each month's medication, okay? So we saw the improvement, but the learning thing from this whole thing was how much we need that mission coworker down there. Because without that person to help coordinate things like this, things get lost, doesn't get tracked and get missed. So that was like the big aha moment. It's like, this is why these things are happening. It's like, we don't have that resource that we had before. So
it could still happen with somebody down there, but it's less likely.
Right.
Because somebody living on the ground there, you hear things, you're just more aware of things, and it's so important to have somebody. I mean,
right.
You can only do so much from afar.
So, but the bottom line, I don't want to put a negative light on Daniel's situation at all. For me, it was a big learning thing, because that was the first time we've ever had to come and ask for extra funds. And he ended up growing like an inch and a half. It was like a couple inches from that one annual treatment of the growth hormone. And he did attend some school. I noticed a huge difference in his self-esteem. When we first met him, he wouldn't talk unless he was talked to. He would always look down. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of energy, I guess. And I noticed a big improvement in that. So I don't think our efforts were in vain. But it's just a continuous learning process.
How old is he now?
11. So where we left it with him was we needed him to go to the national healthcare system, and he had an appointment, I think, in February, where he was going to be seen and get documentation on whether at this age where he's at 11, almost 12, continuing the growth hormone was going to have a continued effect, or if we kind of have reached a plateau. Because we have to make sure that resources that we're getting are going and being effectively used, because that's a huge resource, and there's a lot of people that need that. So I don't know, Kathy, can you add anything to that?
It was a good lesson learned, and it's sadly not the first example of somebody double dipping, if you will. But desperation makes people do desperate things. I think one thing that we came out with this is I think it's important to have a constant financial stream at the pastoral house for things that come, the needs that come through. I think if we could find some way to just support that, that would be incredible, because the only time money gets put into a general health fund, most of the churches have a health fund for their specific communities, but there's not one for the communities that don't have partnerships. And there's a lot of people that come to the house needing medical support, be it a special exam or a special medicine or something. And it can't be something that's needed on a monthly basis, because they can't. But they help with one-time needs, transportation to the hospital, whatever. it would be nice if we could find some way to fund something like that.
Yeah, I think that's one of our big goals. So I have to run. Yeah, I always think like, oh, how are we going to cover an hour? But it's just like, like that. So
yeah, I want to thank Mark and Mike and Kathy. Seek them out at coffee after church for more information and questions.
And if you know people, if you know a pharmacist, a pharmacy tech, if you know a physician or advanced practice nurse or someone that just wants to go and be support staff, any of those people we could use. So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.